This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Heider Verreich is only 29 years old, but he is no stranger to death. As a physician, he's witnessed the deaths of many patients, and he found he had more and more questions about the rituals and rules surrounding how we die. His inquiry led him to write a book. It's called Modern Death: How Medicine Changed the End of Life. He's going to be reading from that book at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh this month. Next month, he'll be at the Regulator in Durham. Also, a special discussion in Orange County in April. But right now, Heider Verreich, a cardiovascular disease fellow at Duke University, joins me in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Frank, thanks for having me at the studio.
Tell us more about this inquiry of yours, these questions that you had that led you to write this book.
Well, part of it had to do with the fact that, you know, I went to medical school in Pakistan, and there I saw a very different face of death. In some ways, similar to, I think, how people used to pass away here in the United States before the advent of medical technology. Death was often very brief. It was, in most cases, instantaneous. We knew very little about it. And most of the times it happened in the community at home. And when I came to the United States, pretty much all of that did not exist anymore. Death, in many ways, was much more prolonged because, you know, we were able to fight off a lot of causes of death that would kill people almost instantaneously. Things such as heart attacks, abnormal heart rhythms, bad infections, violent injuries, etc. And we knew a lot more about death. We knew a lot more about the diseases that led to us dying. And most people, especially in this country and other developed countries, now pass away in healthcare facilities. Almost 4 in 5 of all of us will meet our ends in either a nursing home or a hospital. So just seeing this great contrast led me to think about a lot of questions that I just couldn't find the answers to around me. And that was one reason I wrote the book. The other reason I wrote the book really was that I found myself talking to a lot of patients and family members about the end of life. And what I found surprising was that, you know, oftentimes I would be the youngest person in the room. And obviously the people I was talking to, they knew so much more about life. And yet, as far as the end of life was concerned, they were looking to me for answers. So I wanted to write a book for people so that they could go into those situations armed with information. Nothing can make those situations better because almost always we're dealing with some type of personal tragedy, but at least having some information, I thought, would help them make decisions in the future.
So what were some of those questions that began to arise for you? We'll talk more later about the questions they have, but I want to know about the questions you had.
Sure. So one of the things that, you know, we talk about and comes up a lot during the end of life is the idea of not resuscitating or not doing what are sometimes called heroic measures. And I wanted to know, well, what did we do before there were any heroic measures present? And then when those heroic measures were developed, what happened then before we had any type of legislation or rules or regulations about when not to do these things? And then how do we select, you know, these things, certain things as heroic measures, such as, you know, breathing with a breathing machine or CPR rather than other procedures? So it seemed to me that there was a lot of intellectual leaps that had been taken that, you know, I was very good at doing sort of in the sort of checkbox or logistical way, but I didn't know how we'd come to those conclusions.
You take us back to the 1950s and the development of what was called the iron lung as the time in which we sort of took greater control over the end of life. Tell us about that.
So the history of modern medicine, I think one of the biggest things that that resulted in the evolution of the end of life was, in fact, the development of artificial breathing with breathing machines. And the first time that it was ever tested out on a very large setting was actually in Scandinavia. There was a huge polio epidemic, and you had all these kids who had basically paralysis of their lungs. And what ended up happening was that all these patients were situated in this large hangar where they were all connected to breathing machines. And at that point, they didn't have any automation. So there were the medical students who were there were actually manually pumping those machines as those patients breathe. And really, I mean, I think that was such a, to me, that image is such a stark representation of how We went from an era in which really once you could stop breathing or your heart stopped beating, we could do nothing, to a time when really we can maintain the function of these organs through pretty much the worst types of catastrophes that they see. And what that did was that, coupled with the development of CPR, what would happen a lot of times was when you stop breathing or if your heart stopped beating, that really was the end for most people. We, as physicians, all we could do was say a prayer at that point. But these technologies gave us means to help resuscitate patients in those really, really terrible situations, which is, I think, for the most part, one of the greatest achievements we've seen as a species. Having said that, those advances do come with some collateral things that I think we need to think about more as a species.
And we haven't really. I mean, you can take us back to a time before all of this. A doctor would be at the patient's bedside. They would administer the medicine they had and whatever techniques they knew. The patient would pass away. The family would gather around and say to the doctor, "You did all you could." But in a case now where we can actually extend life artificially, mechanically, what you can do becomes what you must do. And it changes our expectations, doesn't it?
And I think that change in expectation is affecting how we view the end of life. I think many people now expect to have a long life, which is why when something premature happens, people feel cheated out of a long life. We don't plan our lives in a way in which we are accounting for a premature cause of death. For example, many people spend, a good part of their lives training and studying, and whether they're in law school, engineering school, medical school, etc., well into their mid-30s. And we would never make this calculation if our lives were still pretty short. But those expectations also, I think, in some ways hold us back. A lot of times, there comes a time when there's a trade-off between the length of life and the quality of life. And I think those are the situations where I think physicians and family members, patients find themselves in very, very frequently. And those are the reasons why so many of these discussions are so complicated.
And talk about how those expectations, again, and the technology come together. If you take us back to Pakistan, where you say people, first of all, death was instant, it came earlier. But I would also think that people are exposed to death at a younger age. It's more common. We get it. We've seen it. If you're on a farm, you watch animals pass away, and by the time you're 10, you've seen people pass away. Simply not true in this country. You can go into your 20s and not know a single soul who's lost their life.
Not just in your 20s. I feel like, if you look at how people actually pass away in the United States and in other developed countries, if your only exposure to the end of life is through TV or through pop culture, then really you can go very well into even to the end of your own life and without having any idea of what is coming your way. So many times I've been in situations where it felt like people felt like they were in a foreign land, as if everyone was talking a foreign language, and yet what was being discussed was the end of life, death, not a medical phenomenon, but a human phenomenon that all of us must have to face off at some point. And really, I think that's one of the things that's happened when death has been moved away from our communities. It's become a medical phenomenon rather than a human phenomenon. And the fact that, we don't see it for what it is, I think it holds us back and it puts people in difficult situations.
A medical phenomenon and a material phenomenon. And of course, this was the thing that religions historically addressed. And when religion was the science, there was no conflict. Today, we have these cross currents now, living in a scientific world where also religion is alive and plays a very important part in a lot of people's lives. Do you see that come into play? I think maybe the case of David is one. You have a lot of great examples and case studies in your book. David is one that comes to mind, a person addicted to heroin, his heart stopped, and he lost brain function. But their Christian religious belief played an important part in his story.
So, I think there's an increasing recognition about the importance of religion, not just for a patient, but also for a physician in how it affects how people make decisions. I remember David's story very well. David was, middle-aged. He had had a difficult life. He was addicted to heroin. He was still living with his parents. When he basically, came in and had a heart attack, had a cardiac arrest, and for weeks he was on our service without any hope or recovery of any type of neurologic function. In fact, the chances of him recovering were less than 1%, and yet almost very, very surprisingly, he did in fact recover some brain function, just enough to say one word repeatedly. But at that point, it felt like such a big deal and such a big difference. And I think that the case, one of the things that this case really brought up is one of the words that I feel like is something that, you know, physicians find very hard to deal with, and that word is miracle. You know, I mean, I think outside of a medical setting, I think there's an association that this word carries. But within the medical setting, you know, what happens when someone starts hoping for a miracle is that sometimes that miracle takes a lot of procedures. It takes a lot of intensive care unit time. It takes a lot of, there's a lot that has to occur for that miracle to occur. And a lot of times when people or patients become obsessed with this idea, they can completely disconnect from their team. And I think at that point, you know, being connected to, you know, family's religion and spirituality is so important because, you know, a miracle can be anything. I think a comfortable death can be a miracle. You know, a death in which a patient is able to pass away in the comfort of their home or in, you know, around the people they love can also be considered a miracle. So a lot of it is about framing, but we can't do that if we are disconnected from the spiritual side and the spiritual lives of our patients. And I think more and more it's being recognized that, you know, we need to connect with patients, not just in a sort of substantive or sort of objective way, but really as people.
How do you do that? I mean, it seems to me the great gift of the Enlightenment was to free us from a kind of ecclesiastical tyranny where clerical leaders were using their influence to gain power, but not much to help us develop our spirituality. So, we're free. But then it devolves into a kind of vulgar materialism that throws the baby out with the bathwater. I hear you say it. There's something about miracle that we have to figure out as men and women of science to embrace. How do you do that? How do you bring the wonder and spirit back in without devolving back to this kind of a supernatural fear-mongering?
Well, you know, even within technology, you know, it's all about how things are framed. For example, you know, a technology, an advance such as CPR can be considered as miraculous depending on the outcome, right? But when the outcome is good, it is considered a quote-unquote miracle. When the outcome is not good, or then it is considered as futile or something excessive, quote-unquote heroic measures. I think the key really is that, you know, to be aware of the fact that words matter, framing matters, and that, you know, anything, as long as it is framed in a sort of mature way, as long as you can communicate openly with patients and families and focus on their values and then help come up with a plan that can accommodate those values, is probably the way forward. I think, you know, the end of life and death are things that will, you know, in many ways, they will take us back to our sort of more primordial forms of how we are sort of as human beings who believe in agency in everything around them. And so I think we cannot have a system that is completely disconnected from that sort of base human instinct. So it has to do, so, which is why I think if we become completely objective and if we treat the end of life as just something that's just very sterile, then what we risk is that, A, that experience for patients and family members becomes something that's even more difficult to absorb, and then, B, we create a gulf between how physicians communicate with their patients, which then leads to conflict.
What do we do in med school about this, though? Because obviously, if you're talking about techniques, you're talking about procedures, diagnostic techniques and machinery, you need to be attached to the gizmos and know what they mean. Hard to break away from that and then become conversant, culturally competent in the language and understanding of your patient who may come from each of them may come from a very different background. What do we do as doctors how do we train doctors in that?
Right. So, you know, one of the things I write about in the book is just exactly that. You know, if you look at medical schools, we are very good at training medical students to ask very, very difficult things. You know, if we are trained, for example, to take a sexual history from a patient who comes in after sexual assault, that's about one of the most difficult situations that you can face. And yet we are given training to be able to elicit information in a sensitive way, even in that type of situation. And I think just like that, I think it's all about training people and training medical students to be able to elicit a spiritual or history about, or, and one of the questions that, you know, is actually evidence-based, which is a way that, you know, medical students can actually start that conversation, is by simply asking patients, what is the role faith or spirituality play in your life? It's very open-ended. It doesn't make any assumptions, and it leaves the patient to answer either in the affirmative or simply just say no. And I feel like that's something that's worked in my practice and that can really work across the breadth of patients who we see, who are obviously, you know, over, you know, the entire spectrum of both religions and religiosity.
So that's something you can control by changing the curricula in medical schools. What do we do for the population at large? Again, living in a culture where even illness is an insult, and where we're very surprised and haven't talked enough about death. What can we do sort of more generally to prepare ourselves better?
I think the key really is, you know, one of the things that I've learned when I was writing this book is that one of the narratives that drives our race and has always driven our race has always been to view death as the ultimate enemy, as the ultimate adversary. And really, that is the mission of medicine at every level, is to avert death, which is, I think, completely, which is the way it should be. But I think something that needs to be addressed even more is the fear of death. You know, medicine was supposed to make the end of life not just more comfortable, but it was also supposed to alleviate the fears that people have about the end of life. And in some ways, we have failed to do that. I think the key really is that we need to be able to talk about death, not just when it is imminent, not just when it is knocking at the door, but really, you know, at dinner time when everyone's healthy, everyone is doing okay, at times when death is not even close, because, you know, we always wish death to go away and, you know, come back another day. We always wish for it to never occur in our lives or in the lives of our loved ones. But I think the more people get used to talking about it, and talking about it not just in an abstract way, but in a concrete way, about what type of care would they want? What would they consider a good life? What would they consider for themselves a good death? I think that is probably the most important thing we can do to change the culture and narrative that surrounds the end of life and how we relate to it.
Do you see signs? I mean, it's interesting, too, because we talked about the technology, and we're talking mostly about medical technology, but the impact of social media, which is something else you talk about in the book.
And, you know, I think if you look at how the medical experience is felt by, or is sort of the context of medical practice has always been, very, very rigid. It has always been about, you know, patients coming to see their doctors, you know, whether that's in clinic or in the hospital. But I think what social media is doing is that it is opening up avenues for patients to express themselves in a way that they haven't been able to. And in many ways, that's something that's also a modern phenomenon, because, you know, increasingly as the end of life approaches, patients are, you know, usually by themselves. They're, you know, a lot of times they're in the hospital. They don't have their loved ones close by. Many of them outlive their loved ones. Many of them are by themselves. So, and many, many times they experience a gulf between themselves and their treating teams. So really, it's a very, very isolating experience. So, and what I've seen and what others have seen is that, you know, increasingly people are turning to social media to find new ways or sort of new avenues, and they can just communicate their daily experiences. And I've found, at least in my reading and in some of my encounters, that I think patients find a lot of comfort in being able to do that. And especially at a time when death and disease can both be so isolating.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us, Haider Vereich, who is a cardiovascular disease fellow at Duke University Medical School and the author of the new book, Modern Death, How Medicine Changed the End of Life. He's going to be reading from his book February 28th at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Then in March, he'll be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Also a special guest at a discussion on modern death, hosted by the Orange County Department on Aging at UNC's Friday Center. That's going to be April 20th, and we've got all that at our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, we're going to talk with musician and writer John Darnielle about his new thriller novel that takes place in the cornfields of Iowa. Stay with us.